know that there has had to have been some sacrifice, whether it's time or nutrition or whatever it is.
I'm recording myself talking about having a relationship with my chest.
I'm Ben Cunning.
I'm Dave Kennedy.
And this is Hacking Health Podcast.
You did.
Yo, what's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 138. As promised, we have a guest. I'm just going to get straight into it, and I'm going to throw you straight under the bus, Kieran, and I'm going to start off with the question that we finished off on the podcast that you and I recorded. Take your company aside, what does total mental performance mean to you?
Beautiful. So for me, it's the ability to perform regardless as to how you feel, regardless of your thinking and regardless of your suffering. Because if we look at high performers, their ability to perform regardless as to what's going on in the noise, that's what separates the top 0.1% to the 1% to the 10%. So that's it for me in a nutshell, your ability to perform regardless as to what's going on.
Okay. I think that's similar to what I said. I think I said be able to operate without hesitation, I think was my answer. So we're aligned with that. Anyway, for anybody who doesn't know, Kieran runs a company called Total Mental Performance. If you want to do your, tell us a little bit about that, because Dave's here now going, the fuck's this guy? What the fuck's going on?
Essentially, I have two companies. So I've got Total Mental Performance, which is the world's fastest growing mindset and mental performance coaching service dedicated to helping coaches, fitness coaches, and coaching entrepreneurs in that space. Outside of that, I coach high net worth individuals. I also coach athletes, WWE wrestlers, guys that are scaling technology businesses at various different speeds. So that's really what I do. I'm a mental performance coach. So I have a team of coaches, and my job is really to help high-performing, ambitious individuals think, feel, and perform on a completely different league and a completely different level, which touches on to what I spoke about earlier, Ben, which was if we could have a podcast title for this episode, it would be The User Interface of Reality Itself. Because that's really the level of depth that I'm working on. So, yeah, that's essentially what I do in a nutshell.
Well, I like that in the sense that I like the definition of user interface for reality, right? Because I mean, I think everybody has their own perspectives of what reality is, but oftentimes that's not what reality actually is, right? And you like using the example of athletes. You know, athletes can take themselves to a whole different type of mental state, you know, push their bodies much further than their mind can by having that mental toughness. And, you know, I also like to equate that same saying to discipline, right? I think discipline is a component of that, right? Of having the discipline to be able to do something that you don't want to do, that doesn't feel great, to allow you to push yourself forward, even when you may not be at your optimal level. But, you know, all of those things, I think, come into play when you start looking at, like, how do you perceive yourself, and getting into that right mindset to be able to do something, you know, above and beyond what everybody else does, basically.
That's it. Perception is reality. So if we can alter our perception, we can alter our reality.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. I often do the same thing. So like, you know, I always talk a lot to Ben, but like I go to this place called Orange Theory, which is a kind of like a HIIT training workout place. And I do more lifting than Orange Theory, but when I'm in Orange Theory, you know, if it's just me and myself, I don't push myself very harder. But if I create a scenario where I'm competing with the person next to me, even though they're not competing with me, I push myself 10 times harder, right? You know,
every week he comes in, he's like, I won at Orange Theory again. I'm like, hey, you beat the guy. Nobody knew they were in a competition whatsoever, but they have won. And that's all that fucking matters, right?
Right.
So, Gary, you come from a sporting athlete background yourself. Whenever we spoke last time, you know, you talked about essentially everything that you went through. I think if you're comfortable, you sort of want to, I didn't ask you the question as to how much you want to go into it. So we're just going to go into it. So yeah, how you have used your experience, your past to get you to the place that you're in now to coach the people that you coach.
Yeah. So I guess we go back to the beginning. So I grew up in a council house, which is, I don't know what that is in America. Not the projects. It wasn't like whatever, but essentially the government owns these houses, and you're essentially working your way up from the socioeconomic ladder, right? And I actually grew up in a really nice area, and I always never felt enough. So that created, I got lots of messages that I wasn't enough, whether that was at school, whether that was in sporting backgrounds. my dad was my football manager. You guys call it soccer in the States. We were bottom of the bottom league, and he benched me every game. And as an adult, you'd say, we can laugh because it was funny. You must be dog shit at football. Like, you must be really bad. But the reality is, as a kid, I was like, not even my dad thinks I'm enough. And kids make a decision. They either accept the message, and this is a line of code of your user interface of reality. A line of code is born in childhood. You're not enough. And then the decision is made. And the decision is either you're right, I'm not going to try, or fuck you, I'm going to prove you wrong. I went down that route. And that led to pushing and ambition and drive and just working and working and working and working and working. And that's when I walked into a boxing gym and I went, that's for me. I can't get substituted. I can assert my dominance and I can prove I am, in air quotes, the man. I was a boy, but the man, right? And it led me on this 8-year journey. And my goal was to go to the Olympics, and I pushed myself to absolute extremes. I managed to make the England team, wasn't quite good enough to make Team GB. And to kind of put a long story really short, I'm 5'8", but I was boxing at 56 kilos. So I was a giant at my weight, and I was always cutting weight all the time. And boxing is a ruthlessly high performance environment, and you find out whether you're good enough or not. And I had mental performance coaches and psychologists there. Hazel Gale, former kickboxing world champion, British boxing champion, phenomenal woman. And she's a leader in therapy and mental performance and what she does. She coached me all the way back then. And I came to her at the end of my England career because I had an eating disorder. I didn't leave my parents' house for 2 weeks. I was depressed, so I tried to take my own life. And for me, I realized that my ambition nearly killed me. It was the ambitious mind that nearly completely destroyed me. But then I rebuilt, and I went into software sales. And it was in software where I really realized that, oh, I'm actually pretty fucking good at this. And a lot of the principles that I learned in boxing was exactly the same in technology companies. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I tried to set up my own technology business. So it was an app called Make Weight. So back then, there wasn't really any online meal planners or anything like that. I didn't know how to build an app, but I learned Ruby on Rails. And I started like just tinkering along with that. I was like, all right, let me see if I can kind of build something. And I kind of started building this app where you put in your height, your weight, your body shape, and how long you have until you fight and how hard you were training. And I worked with, he's now my best mate, but a nutritionist and a sports scientist to sort of categorize, right, hard sparring equals this many calories, medium sparring equals this. And it was kind of guesswork, but I got to databases and I'm like, I can't fucking do it. So I brought someone else in to do it. And the idea was, I can't build an iPhone app, but we can build a browser app through Ruby on Rails and build it on the website. So when you clicked on it, it looked like an app, but it wasn't really. That was our MVP. And we spent loads of money and we lost loads of money. I ended up in £15,000 worth of personal debt. So was Luke. Didn't work out. Total sort of addressable market was tiny, but I learned so fucking much out of that process. And then I went back into software sales and I spent 6 years there just being immersed in it. So I sold at a company called Ametria, which is a data analytics company. I went into fashion technology, VR, and I loved it. And I loved actually going over to where all the developers were and actually learning about the technology and understanding the intricate details and how they thought and how we could apply those use cases into the market. And it was great fun. Then I got to a point where I was kind of miserable. Like, I wasn't enjoying closing the deals, but I was really enjoying coaching the team. And people often think you have to go to the bottom of another ladder. But actually, if you skill stack and you've already got a series of skills, you can actually just step across. So I was used to having psychological conversations because that's what sales is. That's what leadership is. I was very used to having emotional conversations and dealing with high pressure. I restudied as a therapist, cognitive therapist, NLP practitioner, peak performance coach. And I just started coaching people for free, and I'd made enough money to not have to work. So I took a year out, completed all of my studies, and just started coaching people for free. And they started paying me, and I did a few speaking gigs, and then I hired a team of coaches, and that's how I landed here today. So that's the story. I've done that in a highlight reel. Hopefully that wasn't too lengthy.
Absolutely nailed it. I mean, I think that I'll let Dave speak because he's probably still going like, what the fuck have I just walked into? But I want to ask a biggest lesson from each of those stages of the journey. So we'll talk about your boxing career. We'll talk about trying to develop your own app, and we'll talk about software sales. The three biggest lessons you've taken that stand with you today in the business and the company you run, the people that you help.
Yeah, boxing was unharnessed ambition can absolutely destroy someone. So if you don't harness ambition in the correct way, you'll burn yourself into the floor and you can absolutely destroy yourself. It took me to the point of not wanting to be on the planet anymore for me to really realize that ambition is like fire. It could put man on the moon. It can keep your house warm. It can cook your chops, but it can burn everything down and destroy life at the same time. So you're just going to learn how to harness it. So that was the boxing one. From the app, I guess more practically, understand your total addressable market before you go and raise money and borrow personal debt and fucking try and build something there. That was more practical. And then software sales, very, very similar. It's very similar to therapy and coaching. It's understanding, okay, well, what the core psychological drivers and motivations of this individual, and can you help them or not? And if you can help them, then apply the frameworks that you've learned to go and help them. And if you can't help them, say, I can't help you, but here is somebody that can help you, and then moving them on that way. And then throughout all of them, the ability to deal with pressure, deadlines, stress, being in high performance environments, being surrounded by people that are a lot better than you on the international level. Like, that was really humbling. First on the England team, then I used to sell for a company called Rakuten, who sponsor the Golden State Warriors, I think it is, and Barcelona Football Club. I went and sold for them, and I was on a sales floor, and there was people from New York, Tokyo, but all over Europe. And these were the top people from all over the globe. They put this team together, and I was the youngest and the least experienced. And I was like, I'm the baby and the least experienced, and like all the pressure that comes with that. So those are the top three, and then that was just a sprinkle of all of them on the fourth one.
I'd be curious for the folks that you actually chat with. So I was looking at your site, and so you have a number of like high net worth individuals, CEOs, people that are serial entrepreneurs, things like that. You'd mentioned kind of what drove you to kind of have a mental toughness, right? You know, coming up from your upbringing and things like that. You know, I have a very similar experience, more of a close call with life, I would say, when I was in war in Iraq, that changed my perspective and my drive to go and do things. Do you see commonly that there's a big event or something that causes, you know, successful people to drive themselves even further than most? Like, whether it's an athlete, whether it's, you know, a business owner or an entrepreneur, those types of things. Is there a commonality there that you see, you know, working with your customers?
Absolutely. The fear of not being enough. Like the fear of, yeah, of not being enough and not being lovable and not being worthy, and that you have to make enough money or you have to look a certain way or be able to physically dismember. This is particularly for my male clients. Most of my clients are male. You know, the ability to make lots of money, have a six pack or massive guns and rip someone's face off is typically how we measure. Air quote. I don't like the phrase. I hate the phrase.
It's really built into all of our brains, by the way. But it's like deep seated, like caveman, you know, millions of years ago type of thing that's still in our brains here. But
yeah. Like the darkness of that. So using that darkness to achieve, and then getting to the end of what you believe would make you happy. And I had this moment when I was in London where I had the central London apartment, the senior position, the six-figure salary, all that superfluous bullshit that, why have I got everything I set out for, and
no, what?
Not it. And now, yeah, like now what? And for me, it's depending on where the entrepreneur is in their journey, because if they're a little bit earlier and they're in the trenches, actually that darkness is kind of a good thing. So therapists will try and take that out. That's not what they want at that stage of their journey. Like, that you actually need that. So once you've built up the space and the capital and the team to free that up, to then move over to more of the abundance and the love and the light and that side of things. There are some people that have made exits and they're now in an existential crisis. What do I do? And they can either go and do another sprint in another company, or they can actually look inwards and go, hang on, actually, I need to do something different this time. And that's kind of where I come in. It's usually one of two scenarios. Somebody's achieved all their dreams. They've made it and they've got all the time and the space and the financial freedom. They're like, fuck, now what? Or, holy shit, Kieran, like things are growing like really, really fast and things are moving and I'm struggling to sleep at night. And like, what do I do? Those are the two clients that I typically work with.
I think for me, you know, you're talking about the fear of not being enough, like hard relate on that. And I think many of us can. Do you see, and actually I'll tell a story and then I'll ask the question. So as I said, I was in Vegas and Hormozy was talking. I'm a big Hormozy fanboy. I don't know if you are, but I am, and fully admit it. he was doing a Q&A and someone asked him, like, what does it feel like to have made it? And he stopped dead, like dramatic stop. And he was like, for context, the guy that lives in the apartment above me took home $930 million in income last year. Stopped again, was like, in income, $930 million. So he says, I just lay in bed at night and wonder why I'm so poor. So do you think that that ever changes, that fear of not being enough? Or do you think it's on a scale?
I'm fascinated by Hormozy too. I think he's an interesting guy. I think he's so engrossed in his work. He's in a hypnotic state, which is just grow and scale. And I enjoy this. And I actually think his discomfort in business is his comfort zone. And he's in that. Just like, I'll just do this and I'll do this and I'll do this and I'll do this and I'll do this. And look, I respect the guy. What he's done is phenomenal. But I think that's where he is. I was very lucky. I live in Dubai. So when I first got here, one of my first Dubai clients was a guy worth $1 billion. And I remember peering into his heart, his soul, his mind, and his life, thinking, I would never trade places with you. Self-made guy, built up a hell of a lot of different businesses, and he's got his fingers in all sorts of pies, and he can't sleep at night. He doesn't trust anyone. And even in his inner circle, he's worried, he's stressed, he's anxious. None of that was worth, in my view, the peace. Mm-hmm. And my goal was to help him understand, okay, well, you're not just how much money you're worth. There is another human being outside of all of that. And it was helping him come to terms with that. So I don't think, I'm very much a big believer in horses for courses. So everybody is unique. Everybody has their own tribe. There are some commonalities amongst the clients that I work with. But if you can't enjoy the journey and you're constantly looking at the next guy and you're constantly peering over the urinal, so to speak, you're never going to be happy. So my sort of view is, have something that stretches you and work towards something that's meaningful, but make sure you enjoy the journey. It sounds cliche, but actually enjoying the path of suffering, because you're going to suffer on any path you choose, any ambitious path, you're going to suffer. So pick a process you enjoy suffering in and then just have fun and enjoy that journey and then get to where you want to get to. And I kind of go the opposite, put the blinkers on, ignore everyone else in the market and just do your thing.
That's very much in line with David. You literally said this when we recorded a podcast on Monday, and you literally said, like, again, we were talking about just being in that sort of environment. And you were like, I have done the opposite. Like, I've not paid attention to anybody and just like have had to do my own thing.
Yeah. It's for me, I kind of forged my own destiny. I kind of believe in that, trusting your gut and kind of pushing forward. And, you know, I've never really looked back with that. I mean, we're talking about like books and things like that, that people have, and listening to other speakers. And I have a tough time with that because it's their experiences, not mine. Right. And there might be valuable information in that. And if you need to learn a specific task, whether it's, you know, accounting or finance or something for your businesses, that's a different story. Right. But, you know, I don't read motivational books. I don't, you know, read books that are on somebody else's success. You know, I think that's a great story. Maybe if it's a good story, I might be involved in it, but you know, for me, it's kind of forging my own destiny, not looking at what other people are doing and what I can kind of control in my own situations. And, you know, I've built two very large companies. I'm involved in like, I think 7 or 8 different other companies. I don't even know the number anymore. But I, you know, I have over 450 employees worldwide now at this point, and started from the basement of my house, you know, with nothing there. And, you know, had no idea what I was doing.
Well, right? You need to tell the story of like, you had the job, like you had the career, like you were in the spot, and then you did the fuck it button.
Yeah. Well, I was, you know, I was one of the youngest vice presidents and chief security officers in this company's history. It was called Diebold. There was a Fortune 1000 company. They manufactured like the ATM machines. Wincor Nixdorf is one of their companies as well. And so I was like, you know, at the top of the food chain in our security department, and you know, everything was great. I had a great team. Everything was perfectly fine. And I was like, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life, right? I don't want to work for somebody else in some sort of corporation. And so my wife had just had twins, and it would be our three kids then. And I was like, you know what? I want to leave this perfectly amazing job that I've fought to get here and start my own company in the basement of my house with 5 months of rent in the bank. And we're going to figure out how this goes, you know? And we did it, right? You know, and had no idea. I had no idea how to register an LLC. I had no idea that I needed insurance or, you know, finance or HR or any of that stuff. And, you know, you kind of just figure it out as you go along, right?
There's a metaphor that I love to share with my entrepreneur clients, which is entrepreneurs are just feeling around in the dark always. So like, it's like you're walking around with your eyes shut and your team are behind you. So you've got like these little lights, like straps to the back of your head, and you're showing, hey guys, this is the way, this is the way. But you're like constantly like feeling around in the dark. And every now and then you're, oh, that's it. That's the thing. That's the thing. That's the thing. And you kind of get really comfortable and confident. And then the cheese gets moved. You're like, oh, I've got to find the next thing. I've got to solve this problem. And it's having the confidence and the ability to know that you don't necessarily need to know where it's going. It's just, I'll figure it out.
It's funny you say that, because literally this morning I was talking to Erin, and we're talking about how good things are going. And, you know, and she had made the comment like, you know, I can't believe we did what we did when we did it, because, you know, we're in our 40s now. It's like, you know, we would never do this in our 40s now. And I'm like, yeah, I look back at Dave in his 20s. I'm like, what the hell was that dude thinking? Like what was in your head to go and just leave this and do all this, right? But Erin had said, you know, I think that's a good sign of an entrepreneur, is that you didn't really think about any of that. You just knew you had to go and execute. You knew you had to go and move forward. You had to continue in this darkness, continue to feel your way through. And you never ever thought about failing. You never ever thought about all of the things that you have to learn and go and do. You just went and did it and went with the flow as you kind of figured it out, right? And I think that's the difference in a lot of people. Some folks will stay in their position, stay in their jobs the rest of their life, and they're content, and that's great, right? And there's others that just have this like need to continue to push forward no matter what. And it, you know, in no fear whatsoever of the ramifications that'll happen, you know, if things don't work out. It's just your mind doesn't work that way. It's just, I'm not going to fail because I trust myself and I'm going to move myself forward. That mental toughness to be able to push myself forward. But you know, it was crazy to think back then. We were just literally just talking about this morning. So
I like to say to my clients, it's about being smart enough to know what to do, but being dumb enough to do it. And like, there's so many.
That's a good statement.
Yeah, there's so many, and I work with some really bright people, much smarter than myself, like leagues ahead in terms of IQ and whatever. Yeah. But it's their emotional bit that they don't get. So they're smart, they know what to do, but they're so emotional that they're not dumb enough to actually go, I'm going to start the company. I'm going to invest in that. That's where I come in. I'm like, well, let me dumb me down a little bit for those clients. Let me dumb me down a little bit, because you're thinking too much and you're too clever. And the problem with intelligence is you can spot everything that can go wrong. And if you can spot everything that can go wrong, your perception is your reality and it becomes real, then you can't do it. Whereas if you're dumb enough to go, well, that could happen, but I back myself to figure it out if that does happen, that's the balance. Then you've got the opposite, which is, and some entrepreneurs could win big. They're dumb enough to do it. They're not really smart enough, but they'll keep going and they'll just keep smashing their head against the wall until it goes. But if you can be smart enough to know what to do, and if you don't know, bring in the right advisors that do know.
Exactly right.
And be dumb enough to do it. That's the balance, but that's the hard bit.
And I think a lot of people, especially like folks that have egos and things like that, really struggle with that last component there of bringing the right people in because of assumed power or, you know, struggles with that, or relinquishing control. And those are the folks that don't actually end up making it. I think it's relatively, and this is a blatant statement, I think it's relatively easy to make it in some capacity if you remove your ego, you have a blind sense of faith, essentially, that you're going to push forward, and you surround yourself with amazing people that, you know, believe in that mission and can amplify what you do, because you're not the expert in everything, right? You know, I think that's the difference, is, you know, between, and it's interesting, because just last year, we took funding for the first time. So everything was grassroots, you know, out of the other bank. We took funding for the last time. We brought in a new leadership team. And the reason why we brought a new leadership team in is, you know, I recognized, and my partner, Mike, you know, a good friend of mine, we recognized that we had taken the company as far as we could. And, you know, we're the entrepreneurs, you know, and we needed, you know, our companies had grown so large that we needed a really solid leadership team that has done this before, that had the experience that we didn't have, to take us to that new level. And it really has. Like, we've, you know, we had a record year last year. We continue to have a record year this year. We're growing like crazy. It was a catalyst because we recognized our faults. And we don't, you know, it's funny because I'm not the leader in that company anymore, right? I'm on the board. You know, I made up a cool title called Chief Hacking Officer, but, you know, I have an entire leadership team that runs the company day to day, right? And, you know, I think it takes a special person to be able to say like, hey, I'm not the right person to lead this company anymore, because I've hit my capacity of what I need. I need other people that are strong in those areas to be able to do it. Or, you know, I need to invest in myself hands down to get the skills to go and do it. And is that really the best use of my time? Or can I still be, you know, visionary on our product and what I know really well, which is cybersecurity, not necessarily building, you know, a multi, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars type of company, right? You know, so it's a difference in thinking that I've always, luckily I've ever always had, which is I look at people smarter than me. I'm like, hey, you'd be awesome here because you know this way better than I do. You should take this away from me because I don't know what the hell I'm doing. So, you know, so,
yeah. I think that you said something there about, you know, having fun along the way you do it. And I've been fortunate enough to sit in on some of the like dinners and stuff with the guys from Trusted Sec. And one of the biggest things that I've seen is like, I know you're not going to correct me, but correct me if I'm wrong. Like, you guys and the guys that have been around for the longest have like had a hell of a lot of fun building the business. And like everybody, when we were in Vegas last year, you know, everybody was sort of talking about their Trusted Sec origin stories. And it was just, for me, I was like almost pride dad moment of like hearing how cool the story was of everybody about getting involved in your company. So you've obviously had a lot of fun bringing those people in and bringing those sort of like brighter people in to drive the forward and sort of take what you had built with your name to then build it as the Trusted Sec team and beyond that.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, you always hear from people, and at least in my opinion, that don't know what they're talking about or haven't experienced it, that you should never hire friends and family. And I'm the exact opposite. I'm like, I will hire my friends all day long because my friends don't want to disappoint me, and especially if they're subject matter experts in their own individual areas, that amplifies what I'm doing. I'm not going to hire a friend just to hire a friend. Mm. But if a friend that I know is proficient in something that I need, why not hire a friend that's going to bust his ass for you, that you trust, that you know will do a great job, and have them as part of your team? So, you know, I'm surrounded by people I trust. Like my leadership team, there's zero toxicity, zero. Like if there's a problem, we're not blaming each other. We're figuring out what the problem is and trudging forward to go and do it. And we ran into a situation about a year and a half ago where, you know, I brought in somebody from the outside, and they didn't really understand the business and consulting. They made some really poor decisions that caused us to have some fluctuations in cash flow. And you know, instead of you know, pointing fingers, that person's no longer there. But you know, instead of pointing fingers at each other, we just doubled down, transparent, moved forward, and got out of it. And we had a record year last year. So, you know, it's I think, you know, for me, finding people that are smarter than you, that you can actually trust, that know what they're doing, but also letting them really lead, I think is extremely important. Like anybody in my leadership team could tell me my decision or what I'm thinking of is completely idiotic and I shouldn't be thinking about that. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's probably a good idea. You're right. That is dumb. Okay. You know, like the transparency there, the confidence they have in telling me that it's a bad idea is really important to me. And being able to have a team that just kind of cohesively works that way, right?
You touched on something there, which I've actually got tattooed on my wrist, which is Ego is the Enemy. And the book from Ryan Holiday.
I love that. Phenomenal. I'm going to go get a tattoo right now. Aaron, don't listen to this podcast. My wife, she doesn't mean
phenomenal. Like, absolutely phenomenal concept. And for those listening, just a quick run through. It talks about ego at the three stages. Ego when you're trying to get good at something. Oh, I don't want to do the groundwork. This work is beneath me. Like, who am I to do that? Ego when you win. I'm the fucking man. I am the man. Like, look at me. And ego when you fail. Oh, I shouldn't have failed. And you go depressive and like, oh, I'm this and that, whatever. And Dave, what you talk about beautifully there is the ability to put your ego aside and go, you know what? They might just be better than me at this. And that's cool. And, you know, I see this with founders when they reach that point, which is they don't want to let go. And they do what you could have done, hire in leadership teams or go on management courses and actually learn that. Well, they go, you know what? The person that springs to mind is Ben Shark, Jim Shark, Ben, the founder.
Ben Francis,
that's the one. Yeah. He stepped aside and he went, you know what, I'm not CEO, I'm a founder, and I'm going to step aside and I'm going to bring in a real big dog to come and run that, and off they go. And it takes ego to actually go, you know, I just don't need that. And also putting your ego aside and going, I need help. I was very lucky because of boxing. I learned very early on. A boxing coach called Martin Calvert changed my life. He held up his pads. He went, hit those. I went, okay. And he goes, how good is that? And I was like, yeah, I loved it. He's like, well, keep doing that and you'll be able to do this around the world. And I was like, really? He's like, yeah. And it took me around the world. So I learned very early. Oh, if you can find people that are very experienced and good at what they do and you follow their advice and you listen and you take things on board, like that'll change the game. And I think today, this is why the coaching industry is one of the fastest growing industries in the world. People are actually starting to recognize, oh, I need to put my ego aside because there's somebody more experienced than me, more knowledge than me that can just save me a lot of time and hassle. And I think that was a really beautiful point that you touched on there.
I had a friend that was asking me for advice, and he asked me if I would take a board seat, and I said, sure, no problem. Just kind of more of a advisory board type of thing. And, you know, he was really struggling with the company. And, you know, I looked at, I sat down, I interviewed folks, I talked to his leadership team. I went through the whole company in and out. And, you know, I sat down with my friend, which I've known for 15 years. And I said, it's time for you to bring in a new CEO and you need to step down. You know, like you have done as much as you possibly can. You're now the hindrance of this company growing and you need to move aside. And still, I mean, and I explained to him, I'm like, listen, this is what I did here. Here's how it worked out for me. Right. And I'm not saying it's going to be the exact same, but it's going to be a lot better than you think. Trust me. Like you're not, it's not like you're not the boss. You still own the majority equity of shares in the company. You still can guide the company in the way you want to. You can still do the fun stuff. In fact, what I found was I'm having much more fun because I don't have to deal with all the bullshit every single day, you know, of running a 200 plus person company over here and 150 plus person company over here, whatever, you know, like I don't have to deal with the day to day. And I can focus on the things that really matter, the things that are important, right? And that's, I think, what a lot of people fail on is they put it all on their shoulders and they still have to have all of those responsibilities and they're miserable, right? And then that misery, you know, goes to the leadership team and that misery goes then to the culture of the company, the rest of the people in the company. Yeah. And then the entire company is kind of in a decay or it's not moving the way that it should, right? And, you know, people don't understand how big responsibility, relieving responsibility is. But I also say, you know, a lot of people have a fear of that because one, they're probably already overloaded, right? You know, they're probably putting in 50, 60, 70 hours a week. And then you have to bring somebody in and train them, which is going to add another 10 to 15 hours a week when you're already overloaded. But you have to look at that from a threshold perspective and say, well, it's going to be up here for a little bit. Then it's going to go down, right? And you can go down even further and it might go up a little bit more, but you go down again. Right. And it's this ebbs and flows that we have to play with, you know, as our companies expand and grow, you know, it's very different from when I first started in the basement of my house to when I have all of these employees. Mm-hmm. But one thing that hasn't changed is, you know, relying off of other folks to be able to, you know, play off of my weaknesses to make me stronger and make the company stronger. Right.
So it's really interesting you mentioned that because I was brought in for one of my mentors. He owns a VC. He's a VC and he owns a fund. He said, Kieran, I want you to come work with one of my founders. He's got to get out of the company. And I was like, okay, well, why do you want to bring me in? Like, well, how my first question I always ask anyone is, okay, well, number one, how can I help? And then number two, if you got what you came for, how would you know? And that's what I said. And I said, I need you to help him to come to the terms with he needs to step aside or we're going to have to ruthlessly take him out. Okay. Does he want to talk about this? It's down to him. It's not about me. It's down to him. And he goes, yeah, let's set up a conversation. And there was two things that come up. And number one, he's the sole founder. So forget money and all of that. But let's talk about the emotional bank account. So every time that you have to overcome a struggle, every time you've got to let a team member go, or you've brought somebody on, or you've hit new records or whatever, those are deposits in the emotional bank account. And sole founders can get really attached to their companies. So it's an extension of their identity. So it's not just, oh, let me just fucking, yeah, go and buy it, whatever. It's like, no, this is me, but it's not you. And so there's that. There's so much emotional investment and psychological investment and years. You know, this guy had been in there for 9 years. So there's so much that goes on in there. You don't let that go easily. And then the second part, have you read the book, Who Moved My Cheese?
Nope.
Ben, can you
like
send
I said,
me
I don't read many books at all. So like,
I've got it here. You can read, I don't know if you take baths, you can read
that's
that.
That's way too big for me to read. Let me just say that. That's like 50 pages, man. That's too many.
we were laughing on the podcast on Monday because anytime Dave comes in, he's like, this book I read, there's a list of like three books that I know he's going to say because there are only three books that he's read. And one of them is Rework and there are two other books and that's it. So whenever we decided the other day we're collectors of books. Like you recommended Hooked to me last time.
Yeah.
I have it sat there on top. Like I am committed that I'm going to read it at some point. But if you feel like there's another book that I need to read, I will order it.
And it'll sit there for 6 months.
You can read that, right? In the bath. It's okay. Done. Okay. Really, you can read that in the bath and it's done.
What's the name of the book?
Who Moved My Cheese?
Who Moved My Cheese? All right. All right. I'm ordering it in the bath for a while, but I'll get it.
I tell you what,
Ben, Dave and I need to start as a book club.
Ben, if you send me your addresses, on a personal level, I'd love to gift you both. I'd love to send it over as a gift.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
On a psychological level as well, when you receive a gift, you're more likely to read it than if you buy it yourself. So that's also something in there. But this book, it talks about our resistance to change, right? And human beings don't like change. Like, we absolutely don't change because of death. You know, we got to think our ancestors are fearful people. It was the fearful people that survived, not the idiots that think I'm going to take on an elephant or I'm going to jump off a cliff. They didn't survive. No, it was the ones that were like, whoa. Let's just slow this down.
A bear or a lion is probably not the best idea, right? You know,
yeah. So we don't like to change. So for this client, it was an emotional investment of 9 years and his identity wrapped up in this thing. And the second part was fear of change. And it was actually going out and going, okay, well, what does that mean for me? I've just done this for the last 9 years. What am I going to do now? So when you can really understand and help them come to that conclusion, it's like, well, maybe you don't want to do that. And maybe you need to go and fight the board and you say they're wrong. But actually, if it's just fear and ego, and actually you haven't considered what life could look like outside of that. And that was the penny that dropped for him. I said, well, do you even want to do this for another 9 years? And in the instant, he went, not really. Okay. And then,
Right. Yeah. And it's funny. My wife will admit she is the most apprehensive to change, period, like ever. Right. You know, like we'll have the same furniture and same stuff in our house until I die. Like it will be there because like nothing can change in the house. Like if there's something that changes, like what's that right there? What is that one thing right there that changed? I mean, I just painted the wall so that there's no crack there anymore. Well, that crack is part of, you know, anyways. She also runs finance for our company, right? So she's our CFO. And we have a very, very good working relationship and obviously, you know, great marriage and everything else. And it's funny because, you know, when we started getting larger, I'm like, Aaron, you need to hire somebody underneath you to be able to manage all this because you're stressed all the time. And she's like, well, no, I have to be able to do all this. I'm like, do you like doing all of it? And she's like, well, no. And I'm like, okay, we can afford hiring somebody else that's going to relieve all this burden from you. You can still be, you know, doing the stuff you like to do. You know, what's the pros and cons? So it took like 4 months of coaxing to finally get somebody to hire. And she's great now. You know, it's amazing. But I think it's the fear of, you know, losing what you do, your purpose, what makes you valuable, those types of things, which in retrospect, you know, she got filled with 10 other things. Because, you know, our company's growing, right? So she moved to more important things that were more focused on the growth of the company than, you know, having to do expense reports or things like that, right? So it's just a different, you know, I think, perspective that you've looked at. And to go back to your very first stages of what you said earlier, you know, what is your user interface to reality, right? You know, is it what you're telling yourself? Or if I actually go and do this, is the reality going to be something different? Right. Mm. And I think that's what we really struggle with as human beings, is change is very difficult.
Yeah. Well, if you want to talk about the user interface of reality itself, so a metaphor that I love to use, particularly for my technology clients, is think of the way in which you interpret the world.
You're speaking my language with Ruby on Rails and everything else. I've developed I can program in like 50 different programming languages, and I did a lot of Ruby as well. And the guys that wrote Ruby on Rails, 37 Signals, I'm a huge fan of their book, Rework, Remote.
That's the one.
It's like the three books I've ever read. They hooked me on that one, but Rework is amazing. So
Yeah. Amazing. So like the metaphor I use is, this phone switched it off. I've switched off both my phones for this podcast. Okay. I want you to imagine your mobile phone, right? Everything you can see in the user interface is your reality. That's everything that you can smell. Yeah, that's it. Perfect. That's everything in our reality. It's everything you can smell, hear, taste, touch, your thinking, but not your subconscious thoughts, but your conscious thoughts. That's the user interface. But underneath all of that, just like on your mobile phone, are lines of code. Now, there's going to be legacy code in there that still works. So we don't need to change it. We don't need to fuck with that. And actually, that's still working. So why would we mess about? But then there's also going to be lines of code in there that just aren't useful anymore. And my job is to identify what are the lines of code that is running. So there's bugs from the user interface of their reality. So that might sound very abstract. What does that look like in a practical sense? Fear of failure. Oh, it's all going to come crashing down at any moment, and I'm not going to be able to handle this, and I'm an idiot, and I'm a loser, and I'm that's a bug. That's a bug in your user interface of reality. All right. So what's coming up in your reality, and what are you seeing? So on our mobile phone, it might be the app keeps crashing, keep opening it and it keeps crashing. In real life, it might be a client leaves. I told you it's all going to come crashing down. No, a client just, they graduated. They had a great time and they don't need it anymore. Cool. Let them move on. So then for me, it's like, well, when was that line of code written? Or another one is fear of abandonment. Everyone's going to leave me. My partner's going to leave me, or my company's going to leave me, or whatever. So when we go underneath the hood to identify, okay, well, when was that built? And you'll see that line of code was written when you were seven. You're 7 years old.
It's an interesting way of looking at it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like this.
So you're 7 years old and your dad left. Dad walked out in the family. And ever since then, you've been so afraid of everyone else walking out on you. And in your adult world, that's just showing up as, oh, like my partner's going to leave me. Even though your partner adores you, they're going to leave me. Or maybe it's, oh yeah, but like it's only a matter of time before this all comes crashing down, or my team's going to leave, or this is going to. And it's just that little line of code that was written when you were seven. That's legacy code that's not working anymore. So my job is to go underneath the surface and go
rewrite the code.
Yeah, that's it. Almost like a little bit of QA. It's like, all right, well, hang on. Is this still working or is this not working? No, it's not working. Okay, well, let's update.
Like, explain to me the process of rewriting the code, the QA checks. Like, how do you take something that's deep-seated, like a seven-year-old father leaving, and rewrite the code so that it's no longer triggered or pulled from that code base, that old repository, anytime that function is checked, you know?
Yeah. So I'm a therapist as well as a performance coach. So where we've found our unique, our unique differentiator at TMP in that company and what I do is we're all qualified therapists with high performance corporate backgrounds and leadership backgrounds. So what that means is we can identify the lines of code on an unconscious and psychological route, but we can actually apply it in a real world scaling a company context. So let's say, let's use fear of failure. Fear of it's always going to come crashing down, right? That comes up a lot with a lot of my clients. So, okay, let me understand the emotion. Like, where do you feel it? Is it in your head? Is it in your chest? Oh, it's my chest. When is it worse? When I get this email or when this happens? Okay. And have you always had this, or was there a time when you didn't? I've kind of always had it. And I use various different techniques from the therapy world, depending on where the client's at. If they're open, they're like, fucking go for the jugular. Then we go for the jugular.
Yeah.
And we'll take them to their childhood. And we'll have a conversation with their inner child to understand what's really going on here, and helping them as an adult reprocess certain memories and certain events using direct in-session techniques to help them update that line of code. But then also journaling techniques outside of that to reinforce that. So now we've gone to the root cause. We found the legacy line of code. We've helped them update that. And then at the end of a session, I use something called hypnotic suggestion. So I write client scripts. I do this between sessions and I do it on the spot, where I've written a 10-minute recording for you to listen to before bed every single night. And that is just, it doesn't quite work in the coding sense, but almost like doing the reps.
It does. It actually does. So with newer types like large language models and artificial intelligence,
the more data you throw at it,
the more learning models that update themselves and make better decisions based off of it. So it kind of does now. Yeah, it's a good principle.
Thanks, Dave. You made my metaphor even more short. It gets better. Right. So I get my clients to listen to that stuff every single night before bed. So now, and it's bespoke. It's not just some random thing. No, I'm using your metaphors. If you're a coder, I'll be talking about lines of code. My client that's in the WWE, we're talking about wrestling and we're talking about his world and how that works. And by doing that, you're able to update the lines of code a hell of a lot faster than just some generic sort of motivational mindset stuff or like some stress management techniques. So that's kind of going into the user interface of reality itself. It's, okay, well, what's going on here? And that, if you're a founder, that's extremely valuable, because everybody knows the biggest bottleneck is how you think, feel, and perform, which is where Ben comes in and gets you really feeling on a completely different level from your energy. And my job is just to work with the mind and your perception and to help you do that. So that's on like the bug side. Then there's the innovation side. So it's, maybe you work better at night. So once we put in the groundwork, the emotional heavy lifting, it's like, okay, maybe you work better at night. So why are you turning up to the office at 8 a.m.? Well, everyone has to, and I kind of have to do this and that. It's like, well, no, let's say your guys are developers, right? So if you do your best coding at, say, 7 to 11 p.m., but you're trying to do it all at 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. You're using more energy and you're producing more shit code. Why would you do that? So then that's where I'm looking at the performance element once we've got the foundational work in. So it's almost like the opposite. Don't take creatine and all, like, you know, the top level supplements before you've actually got your training routine, your sleep and your nutrition sorted. Our version of that is doing the emotional work so you're more stable, and then we can start looking at the performance stuff. So that's the two. That's the user interface of reality itself, is how I look at it.
I need some bug fixes when it comes to cold plunging. So yeah, I have some deep-seated hate for cold plunges. So
Dave, from a plant executing, tick the box, get shit done, like willingness to do absolutely anything, Dave has been top-notch in terms of that. Will not get into a fucking cold plunge or do a cold jar whatsoever.
That's a hardware issue.
Doesn't care about the benefits.
Go back. There actually is cause for it. I hate cold, and there's a reason I hate cold, because it brings me back to when I was in Iraq and I was freezing my ass off all the time. And I you know, it reminds me, you know, it subconsciously reminds me, at least I think it does, of that wartime situation, because I was freezing. Believe it or not, it gets cold as shit in Iraq, freezing air cold. And then we'd only have cold showers. So I'd have to bathe in cold ass showers while it's cold outside. So I'd always be cold. So whenever I get into a cold plunge, it shocks me back to that time frame. So anyways.
That makes total sense. That's the line of code in the user interface of reality itself. Mine is a time of depression and anxiety and all the anxiousness. I was in London. So it was always dark, cold and rainy. So since then, I've lived in Spain, I've lived in Dubai, and I won't live anywhere that's cloudy and rainy and dark and cold, because it puts me back into that space. Whereas the character in this version of reality, he's always been in the sun and he loves it. So I really resonate with you on that one.
To be fair, when the first time that Dave told me that, I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to close down the cold plunge conversation from now on. I don't think I can top Trump that one. So we'll go from there.
It's not me being a total bitch. All right. It's not me being a total bitch. There's a reason.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Fair.
It's not like I don't want to. I want to be cool with all you all as well, doing some Wim Hof breathing and then the cold plunging and passing out and dying. But, you know, like,
just not for you.
Not for me.
Fair. Right. Well, I know we started a bit here. I don't want to keep you any longer. First of all, thanks for joining us. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely.
Where can people find you?
Yeah. So there's a couple of places.
Dubai.
I'm in Dubai, but I'm actually in a cult. I'm in like a little quiet part. I'm not where all the Burj Khalifa and all the Lamborghinis are. I'm like a little nice part of nature, and it's quiet, and people are quite chill where I am. So. You can find me in this little corner. It's called JVC. But outside of that, if you're on Instagram, at Total Mental Performance, if you're a founder or you're somebody in that space, then message me. I would say klo@totalmentalperformance.com, and check out my website, kieranoneal.com. That hasn't been updated in 4 years, but it will be. And outside of that, I just fucking love this shit. So if you've listened to this and you found it helpful, or there was an insight that landed, just send it to me. Or if you've got a question, send it to me and I'll send you maybe a book recommendation or an article. Or I like sending YouTube videos, but like, listen to this 4 minutes here and you'll really enjoy it. I message me anytime and I'll reply and I'll help out wherever I can.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on. I will drop the details in the show notes. If you've got something to say.
No, I was going to say, Kieran, pleasure to meet you in person, man. And, you know, I really liked the analogy and bridging things between technology, brains, bugs, fixes, things like that. That resonates really well with me. And how I think about things, you know, analytically and data wise in my life. But really cool what you've been able to do with bridging a lot of the scientific research around therapy and, you know, being a therapist and being able to bridge that to, you know, really setting a mind straight and then working on optimization, which is very similar to what we talk about, you know, in Hacking Your Health, which is, as you mentioned, instead of doing creatine and whatever supplement or fad diet, you know, why don't you get an understanding of what calories you're eating, you know, focusing on, you know, getting protein, focusing on setting, you know, your sleep goals, focusing on, you know, being consistent at the gym. And then from there, you can start to optimize and get better. You got to get your head straight first, your routine straight first. And then from there, you can start to build the success there, right? It doesn't come instantly. There's no magic pill. I was going to actually make a joke when you first started talking about, you know, your business. I'm like, oh, what special pillar piece of technology do you sell that fixes all this, right? Yeah. You know, it's a joke, obviously, but that's what people first jump to. And it really requires us to have to go down and do the work to figure out those lines of code that are bad, to readdress them, to rewrite them so that we can be a better person, you know, overall, and optimize ourselves, you know, our businesses, what we do from a high performance perspective. And you obviously work with a number of high performers. That's really what it's all about, is just making ourselves better, right?
That, but the final piece is just enjoying the journey. Yeah. Now, not everybody wants to enjoy the journey. Some people want to build out of darkness and chaos and stress and like, fuck you, I'm going to prove you. That's cool. That's not my crowd. My crowd is, no, I want to do stuff that's fun and I want to enjoy it and I want to enjoy the journey, but I'm getting in my own way of stopping it. So the only cherry on top is being a better person and performing and optimizing for your whole human potential, but enjoying it and having fun on the route. That's really the final bit. But I've deeply enjoyed this conversation, guys. Ben, if you send me your addresses, I would love to gift you Who Moved My Cheese. I'd love to send that over. This book changed my life. I've read it 10 times. I'm like you, Dave.
I've read Rework 10 times. So that changed my life.
I only have read a few books, loads of papers, but on my research, but just a few books. And when I recommend them, they're not like, read this one. It should shake up your reality a little bit. So I'd love to send you this as a gift. And I've deeply enjoyed it. So thanks, guys.
Thanks so much, Steve. I'll get that sent across. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back to normal programming, just Dave and I, next week. Hopefully it'll be on time. Or maybe I'll have a surprise guest. Who knows?
Sorry for my lateness and tardiness. It's been one of those crazy days where everybody's getting breached in the world. So, you know, I'm trying to save the world. So it's my bad.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
See y'all.